Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA Podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we have a special treat for you. Joining me is Yaron Weitzman, the author of a new book about the process Sixers. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. And we're now being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter, at Spreaker. Joining me today is not my very stable genius of a co-host, Morten Jensen. Unfortunately, and I'm sure it's a total coincidence, that he couldn't join me for the one episode where we're going to talk about the Sixers for an hour. He is, of course, very upset about that. But instead, we do have the author of Tanking to the Top, The Philadelphia 76ers, and the most audacious process in the history of professional sports. Yaron Weitzman, he is a writer for Bleacher Report. Yaron, how's it going, man?
I'm good. Also, I should have, first of all, thank you for having me. I should have asked you before we started recording. The NBA Pod, that name was not taken. That's a great name. I can't believe I was saying this actually when I was looking it up. Because, you know, I have a list now because it's a little crazy. This is going to make me sound like a douche, whatever. But, like, doing a lot of media, so I have a list. And just was looking at it, and I was like, the NBA podcast? Like, how does NBA.com not own that? So, anyway, kudos to you guys.
That was all Mort. He was, like, a couple years ago, he was like, this doesn't exist, and I don't know why, but let's take it before someone else does.
It is SEO, if that still matters, then you guys should be striking gold. I don't know if it still does, but that is
right. That was our whole like underpants gnomes scheme. Like step one, claim the NBA podcast. Step two, question mark. Step three, profit. We are still in step two. but Yaron, thanks again for joining us. Before we get underway here, can you let listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can get the book?
Yes, of course. On Twitter, my name sounds, Yaron Weitzman. You could find me on Twitter there where I have all the links. The book will be out March 17th, but it'll be available where all books are sold, assuming a pandemic doesn't wipe us out by then. in the meantime, or you can go straight to delivery, right? You can get it sent to you. But yeah, you can pre-order it online, Amazon. If you go to my Twitter page, you can see a link to the publisher page where we have links to all the great, wonderful places that sell books. So yeah, check it out.
Very good. Yeah. So we are recording this on Wednesday, March 11th, as just a heads up to everyone. It's going to come out next week. So if something happens between now and then, as Yaron mentioned, pandemic destroys everyone, gets the entire NBA sick, they cancel the season, Joel Embiid gets dysentery, whatever, we will obviously not be able to react to that, just to give you a heads up. Also, Yaron, I was telling you before we started that this book, I mean, I've been following this team for 10 years, at least, I mean, like writing about them for 10 years. This book put me in the spot that my co-host Morten is in. He's a long suffering Bulls fan who has basically lost all confidence in ownership at the front office and like basically just hates himself for still following this team. Your book has put me in that same exact place with the Sixers.
You're welcome.
I mean that as a compliment. I really do. And last but not least, I know you, as you mentioned, you've been doing the media tour. I've heard you on Beck's Pod, the Rights to Ricky Sanchez guys. So I know you've been answering a lot of these same questions over and over again. We'll inevitably have some overlap here, but I'm going to try to at least get a few different questions your way.
That's fine. You know, no, all good. Yeah. It's first of all, any writer who pretends they don't like talking about themselves or their own work is lying. Like, I don't write. Like, I write because I want people to hear what I have to say. Like, what? Otherwise, what's the point, right? So there's that, and you know, no, I genuinely and truly appreciate anything. I was gonna say anything nice, but not even nice. Just all anyone having interest and caring about this project. You know, I put a lot into it, so you know, I'm happy to do it.
Yes, very good. So let's start with the question everyone's been asking you. You would not describe yourself as a Sixers fan before writing the book, right?
No, I mean, so I'm not yet. And I say this not from like a higher than now journalist. I mean, I'm not a fan of anyone now. I think that happened naturally. I grew up a Knicks fan, though. I grew up in New York and grew up a Knicks fan.
So then what convinced you to write about the Sixers and this particular era of their team building?
I was a little naive, honestly. I mean, like I wanted to write a book. I was covering the team a little bit for Bleacher Report during the 2017-2018 playoffs because there were no New York teams that were good, right? New York and Brooklyn, Knicks and Nets just weren't giving me anything to do. Started showing up, around them a little bit. Thought, I always wanted to write a book. The Sixers, that seems like a book topic. I don't see anybody else doing it, which was very wrong. let me see if I can do this. And that was really it. Like, I wish I had a better answer where, like, you know, I wish I could say I've always been fascinated by team building, or, I mean, as much as any other fan I was, but, like, it was more of a practical reverse engineering, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know I've heard you say this, and you even mentioned it in the book, that you thought you were going to write, like, basically Moneyball 2.0, but then it turns into more of a tale about palace intrigue. But I mean, to your credit, I think you kind of towed the line between both. Like, the first half of the book really does focus a lot on the Moneyball side of things, like how they got here, what Sam did those first couple years, and then you start to see the cracks form and widen and widen and widen, and then we get to where we are now. So I think you actually did both, which is
great. It's like, right, because, I mean, I just figured, right, that was like, yeah, when reporting and talking to people about Hinkie, or like, I would, like, a big, people who were around them, I would be like, so tell me what the draft process was like. Like, I just felt like to tell the story, like, and the draft was such a big thing, you just have to show, I needed to try to show what was Sam Hinkie doing that was so, quote-unquote, radical or different. And if maybe the answer would have been nothing, I don't know, but I just wanted to, I thought that was important to just sort of take readers behind a little bit and let them see, okay, so this is what a Sam Hinkie draft looks like. Yeah.
So what, going into this project, you weren't a Sixers fan, as you said. What did you think about the process as just an objective NBA writer?
I guess if I'm going black or white, I leaned towards pro, right? Like, you know, I'll relate it back to New York. Like, I laugh when people say you can't rebuild in New York because fans won't accept it. And I always thought that was ridiculous. Like, I'm a Mets fan, right? I never bought that. As a Mets fan, I never bought that. Like, I always consider myself, I guess, a more educated fan growing up. And I believe a lot of people are, right? And a lot of people shared my beliefs. I'm a little younger, and I'm a little more analytically, not like an analytics guy, but I understand how to use them, and I respect them, and, you know, I relate to them, I refer to them in my work, right? Numbers and things like that. So I guess I would lean toward pro, but I also thought, again, coming from the outside, my feelings were, yeah, rebuilding makes sense. This is really good, but also, man, they missed out a lot of lottery picks, right? That would be kind of like my summation of it, right? It's kind of my thoughts.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was not as, like, I'm not as gung-ho as the rights of Ricky Sanchez guys who you spoke to. Like, I'm not fully in that cult, but, like you, I was more pro than con. The underlying strategy made sense to me. I never thought Sam did everything 100% perfectly, which we'll get into shortly. But, yeah, I mean, I am glad to see that you, and I think you did a great job of this, you really did present the objective, like, this is what he did. This is where it started to go wrong. You know, what could he have changed to have made things differently, or could he have done anything differently? I mean, that's going to remain an open question. But
for sure,
I've long believed that you can't even start the story of the process. Like, a lot of people start it with Sam gets hired in 2013. He trades Drew, gets Nerlens Noel, like, starts tearing down the team immediately. But, like, I think you need to provide the context of, okay, well, why did he come in, take over the team, and immediately decide we need to take a sledgehammer to this thing? And I've always said you got to start with Andrew Bynum, because this is where, they trade for him in the Dwight Howard deal, give up Iguodala, Mo Harkless, Nick Vucevic, a first-round pick, lose, basically their entire youth pipeline. You actually start the book even earlier than that, which I thought was really fascinating, because this is something – again, for Sixers fans out there, even people who have been following the team for a long time, these were details that I just didn't know. So what was your thinking behind kind of starting? You started in, like, the Iverson era and kind of the downfall of that.
Yeah, it's just like, I just feel like you need the context, right? Like, how do we get here, right? That's kind of the question. And while doing the reporting, I found that, like, I found, like, a symmetry would be the word, right? The idea that the Iverson trade was really the trigger that set this all in up, right? That the idea that they were going to trade him, they didn't. They ended up going to the finals that year. Then they hold on for him too long, and they make the trade. And in that trade, they get Andre Miller back, and they win too many games, basically. And they end up drafting – they get Thaddeus Young instead of Kevin Durant. And people – and, you know, it's easy to say in hindsight, so maybe, you know, maybe people are lying. And obviously Billy King would say this, but other people – who worked with him said this too, right? That he would, like, the Greg Oden Durant draft, he wanted Durant. Like, he, like, that was the guy, that was his guy. Like, he saw him in a college game, he thought he was amazing, called right away, said, this is the guy who I would take. And, you know, obviously a lottery, a lot can happen, but they lose out on him, they get Thaddeus Young, and that's kind of, and so because, like, they made the Iverson trade and correctly recognized that they had plateaued, right? So you give Billy King credit for that, but they just didn't go all the way with it, and it kind of set up the need to go all the way seven years later or whatever. And I found that fascinating.
Yeah, it was really – I mean, the parallel you drew between, you know, they had the chance to do this. They went some of the way, but not all the way, you know. And then we're basically on the treadmill of mediocrity. Like, you went through the Eddie Jordan era, the short-lived Eddie Jordan era. Yeah, you know, Doug Collins for a couple of years. And that's – it was like that time in, you know, following the Sixers where fans were really like, all right, let's just choose a freaking direction here. Like, either go all in on winning now or go all in on rebuilding. But, like, we're towing the line with a 35-40 win team. Nothing is happening. Like, we got, you know, they got lucky. Derrick Rose gets hurt. Joakim Noah gets hurt. They win that series. And I think it was 2011, 2012. But then, you know, they correctly realized, like, oh, this was luck. This wasn't like, you know, this team would have beaten the pants off of us had those guys not gotten hurt. So then, like, that kind of led to fans being willing to embrace this hinky, like, okay, you know what? We're just going to suck for a couple of years, but we have a long-term plan in place. And, you know, in 2013, that was where Sixers fans, a lot of, like, people like you and I and younger people were willing to embrace that. And the owners were too at first, which is really the kind of the theme of this book is, you know, in 2013, everyone was on board, you know, and then we just start, the train starts to get rolling a little bit and it derails pretty quickly. So where do you think things really did start to get off the rails for Hinkie and with the ownership group?
That's a good question, actually. I hadn't thought about it like that, right? I've been asked, like, the other way around, like, what broke, like, you know, so I use the Okafor as kind of, like, the saga as being, like, the straw that broke the camel's back, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a hilarious phrase when you think about it. But, yeah, it's funny. So what led to it? That's a great question. Like, or where the start was. I mean, the start was, in a way, Sam's personality, I guess, right? Like, there's this little – I guess the answer is there is no answer. It's just, like, little things, and that's why something like Okafor, and that's why that dumb straw metaphor works, right? It's, like, just little things piled on top of little things, piled on top of little things, and keep going and going and going and going. And eventually it becomes just too much and too many winds and too many storms swirling. Like, I'm trying to think. Like, there was – like, I get, like, you can say, like, the Jrue Holiday trade where he pisses off an agent, right? And that kind of summarized it. I mean, like, in a way, and I think I even wrote this, right? That trade, like, that foreshadowed everything because you have not – you have him trading a star, right? An all-star, which is – it's just – it's interesting to look back on, like, if they had kept those guys all around. But that's a separate one. But it's like Jrue Holiday is still really good, right? All these years later, everyone else is gone. He's still really good. But you have that happens and you don't talk to involve the agent at all. And there's good reasons for that, but it's also not usually how things are done. So you do that and they draft a hurt center, right? A young hurt center, which kind of foreshadows plenty. And the guy's got, it's a player that they probably didn't do, or if they did do enough, they didn't care either. Or I'll call it intel gathering, right? In terms of the kind of structure that Nerlens Noel needed around him. And like John Calipari told me, he's like, we tell everyone, you're gonna draft our guys. Our guys are 19 years old. They're coming from a really structured, disciplined program. Like that's, which is as that's like, you know, Calipari's not gonna say to the six, he's not gonna say, yeah, I told him he needs a lot of help. Keep an eye on this guy. But that's pretty blunt, right? And he's saying that. And the six just didn't seem to care or put much, I don't know, effort or energy into that. So I guess, I mean, yeah, you want to say that foreshadowed the whole thing. Now it's kind of the first step. Sure. Yeah, I guess that'd be the answer. Like the thing that started, that triggered the process is sort of what laid the ground also for Sam's downfall, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, the reporting at the time, there was always like the, not only, you know, there was the, is he building a losing culture, all that stuff,
right,
which
right.
was, but then there was also like, I think Woj kept kind of hammering this home, like, he is pissing off the agent community a lot here.
Yes.
And your book does a really good job explaining like why that ended up backfiring in a big degree. And it was really the 2015 draft where it came back to haunt him the most, it seems like.
Yeah, like that the Okafor draft, right? I lose track of my year.
Yeah. Yeah. And that Porzingis, like, not being willing to come and work out.
Right, and that sums it up. And like I use that as an example, right? Because the Porzingis not coming in for a workout, like both sides could use that, right? The people who are pro Sam and complete absolutists in their loyalty and belief in him can say, well, you know, he didn't want him. There are other reasons why his agent Andy Miller would have wanted him to work out. Like he had Nerlens Noel as his client. Like you don't want two top five picks from the same position working out together, right? Playing on the same team together, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I get that, but there's also, like, I don't know. The NBA is a small world. It's not like other businesses. And I would love to see the math. I actually meant to do this at one point for the book, but I think I didn't, just to throw it in a line. But like, I don't know. Let's say I'm going to make this up. 50% of the league is represented by five people, right? I'm making up that number. But like, so there are a lot of agents, but if you're kind of dividing the clusters, it's you're dealing with a lot of the same people over and over and over. And Sam thought that wouldn't matter, and I think he was wrong. I think he was wrong from two points. I think he was wrong from the perspective of it won't matter in terms of how I build my team, which I think he's wrong about. And I think he was wrong, like, you know, the political part, where part of your job is to stay employed, to stay in power, to keep your job, especially if you think like you're doing this. Like, it's almost like if you believe Sixers fans, if Sixers fans need you, and I'm not saying he was like an egoist like this, but if you believe Sixers fans need you to do this and you have a plan and they're going to stick with it, like, then part of your job is to stay in power so you can stick with it, right? That's like, you know, in politics, the job is to be elected.
Right.
So there's other ways to do it, but like that's step one. And he completely, I guess, I don't know, he completely left that part to go. Like he wasn't careful there and didn't mismanage that part.
Yeah, and not to draw a direct comparison to the current political climate, but it almost feels like he was more in the Bernie Sanders camp than the Joe Biden camp, where he just
it's funny. No, it's a good comparison. I hear you, right? Taking out the morals, taking out the actual principle, not the principles, the stances, right? The idea that I'm going to stick to my thing and I don't care. I don't want to play the game. And you know what? You got to play the game a little bit if you want to get the position, right? That's just how it goes.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that was the number one question I had about the entire Hanky era, was that 2015 draft. Because I at the time, I mean, it's in your book as well about, you know, Porzingis refuses to work out. I think Woj was the one who reported at the time, or the New York Post or someone. You know, he also had, like, Porzingis wasn't working out. I don't remember specifically if he mentioned the Nerlens component of that, or if it was just, like, Porzingis doesn't want to go to the Sixers, and it's unclear why, maybe because of Hinkie, maybe because of, you know, what he's hearing behind the scenes, whatever. But my number one question was always, like, Okafor was such a not Hinkie pick, like, in terms of the style of play that he prioritized, in terms of the skill sets that he prioritized, taking this kind of, you know, guy who's better suited to play the 90s than in 2010s, it seemed so strange. And I've always wondered, and I was like willing to go to my grave thinking, like, the owners pressured him into taking this pick. Like, he went for the home runs in 2014 with Embiid, knowing he's going to be hurt the whole year. Saric is going to be overseas the whole year. They're not going to get better. They needed a safe double rather than another potential home run in Porzingis. But your book actually makes it seem like Sam had more of a choice in that than, you know, I would have thought he did.
That was my read on it. Obviously, you know, I didn't get to speak to Sam on this, so he could say otherwise, right? But that was my read on it, that, like, it was a value play, right? It's not that they loved Okafor. They thought, like, compared to Michael Carter-Williams, right? They draft him, he wins Rookie of the Year because he gets good numbers, you trade him for something better. I think they thought that, like, D'Angelo Russell was the guy they wanted, right? That would have been that they were hoping the Lakers would take Okafor and Russell would fall to the Sixers, and then like then the pieces make sense, right? Then you have the big guy and the point guard, but it doesn't happen. And they get Okafor and Porzingis. They were concerned about Porzingis. Now again, the part that's funny is Okafor didn't work out for them either. Also because Bill Duffy, his agent, didn't want him to. And wasn't a fan there of what was going on. So like, again, Hinkie didn't not take Porzingis because he didn't work out for him, and Hinkie knew that he was being given the runaround. But the way I phrase it is like, Hinkie was also somebody who said everything is a data point. So maybe if Porzingis comes in for a workout, you say, oh shit, Kai Kerss. But this guy's the guy. Like this guy is there's something special about this guy. And you take him. And that's where the relationships matter, right? That's where the little things matter, because it offers you the ability to learn and discover and get new data points to inform your decisions. But the Okafor thing, yeah, I think like they weren't ecstatic, but I think they kind of figured, okay, we'll take him and we'll deal with it later, right? We knew he didn't care about fit. We know that. It's like Hinkie wasn't worried about positional fit. And like the phrase he would always tell people, if we get Duncan, if we have the three centers and they become Duncan Robinson and Hakeem was the other one, I guess he would, or Ben Wallace, I don't know, whatever it is. Let's say David Robinson, Hakeem Olajuwon, Ben Wallace, or whoever the three. That's a good problem to have. Now, like, I kind of disagree, because I feel like if you put Ben Wallace, Tim Duncan, and Hakeem Olajuwon on the same team, like, they don't become those guys, right? I think, like, right. Keeping the pathways open and stuff matters, but he kind of disagreed. And, you know, where he was right is if you take away the off-court stuff his rookie year, like, he averages 17 points a game, probably makes the all-rookie team. Maybe he does have value, right? Maybe there is some other ending to this where he could trade him or trade someone else where things fit. So yeah, and that part, I mean, the off-court stuff kind of killed all that. But no, it's interesting. Yeah, because I agree with you. I think they were stuck, and I think no one wanted to trade with them. No one wanted to trade up, and it's like, what are you going to do? You have to take somebody.
Yeah. I remember Kevin Ding was still writing for Bleacher Report at the time, and I think he was the one who broke it the morning of the draft that the Lakers were going to take D'Angelo Russell. And that whole day, I'm just going around like, oh God. Like, I know what's coming, and I'm actively dreading it, because, as you said, the fit was just so questionable from the start, even though Embiid was going to miss that whole second season, so it was just going to be Nerlens and Okafor. But ultimately, you have the problem. You're going to have three centers. That's going to give other teams leverage. Like, they know you're going to need to trade one of them, if not two of them eventually, which they ended up doing. They know, like, Nerlens is not on his rookie contract forever. Like, there was a limited amount of time that you would have these guys without having to make a decision of, okay, which one's the keeper. And
by the way, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, as we're talking, I'm like looking up, like we give Hinkie, I'm looking at the 2015 draft now, right? Like, it's not like there was a ton of guys there to take. So I'll give him credit. Right. It's like, so, you know, Porzingis goes four, then Hezonja five, Cauley-Stein six, Emmanuel Mudiay seven. And Hinkie was one of the, he might've been the only, Hinkie went to China to scout him. So like, he put a network. So that's clearly a decision. Like, they decided not Emmanuel Mudiay, who was the second best point guard in the draft, right? And that's the position they wanted. Stanley Johnson, Frank Kaminsky. So you have Justice Winslow 10, Miles Turner 11, and Devin Booker 13. Which you can't criticize him. Like, obviously he's a good player, but the guy goes 13. It wasn't just him. So like, it's not like the options. So you could see how maybe Okafor wasn't his type of player, or that front office type of player. But like, okay, well, we have the third pick. You have to pick somebody, right? I guess you can. You officially don't have to pick somebody, but you kind of do. So.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, they figured the guy's got the pedigree. He was a highly ranked recruit coming into college. Right. He wins a title. Like, he's not going to lose all of his value right away, right? I mean, but then I think the way the NBA changed, what the Warriors did, especially with, you know, basically making back to the basket bigs so irrelevant so quickly. Really, I mean, it wasn't Okafor is not the only one who got hurt by this. Like, Roy Hibbert flushed out of the league in like 3 years, going from all-star to like barely on an NBA roster. And now, you know, guys like Enes Kanter are, you know, go from max contracts to having to settle for the room exception. So like, Okafor isn't the only one who gets punished by this, but unfortunately the Sixers draft him in a paradigm shift that ended up hurting both them and Sam. And then, so you get into the book, and, you know, any Sixers fan will remember the 2015 season, Okafor has a string of off-court incidents, many of which are alcohol related, a couple of fights, one in Philly, one in Boston. He gets a gun pulled on him in Philly. In Boston, you know, it's all over TMZ, and this is when the league gets involved, which remains a very sore spot for a lot of Sixers folks. Because, you know, I think you say in the book, like, the league calls the next day and is like, why the hell is this guy on TV, like, on every major national TV station being talked about, and no one told us. So, you know, you were saying earlier, like, this stuff is what broke the camel's back. Do you think in a hypothetical world, if the Lakers take Okafor number two, D'Angelo Russell falls to number three for the Sixers, do the owners still sour on Sam Hinkie as quickly as they did?
That's a good question. I mean, short answer, I guess probably not, right? Like, I guess because Russell plays better in rookie year and you have things happening. But I mean, also, they were still going to lose a lot of games, and the blood was already in the water, right? Like, on a lot of things, from the financial part of it, from the agents upset, like, a lot of the other factors still remain, right? Agents still weren't happy. Opposing owners, you know, weren't, like, Mark Lazary said to me, like, gave me a quote, like, it's pretty simple. Fans don't like showing up to see bad teams, right? Like, he was, so other owners aren't happy. The business side's not happy. The league's not happy with how blatant it is. So yeah, it's a great question. Like, did this just provide cover for something that was going to happen anyway? You know, as I'm talking about, though, no, I think otherwise, because kind of like what really happened is Josh Harris cares what people were saying, and like, he got, like, people got to him, right? Which I mean, so I guess I care what people are saying too, so who am I to judge? But it's and that would, I don't think that would change, right? I think there would have been other stuff. Like, I think, like, the people, agents, friends, owners, all the league, like, everyone's telling him, this, we got some, this Scott O'Neill, everyone's telling him things like, this is not okay. Things need to change. I feel like that would have happened anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the impression I get from reading this, is ultimately, like, the owners were on board in 2013. By 2015, they kind of lost the stomach for it. And then, you know, they bring in Jerry Colangelo, leads to, you know, trying to demote Sam a couple months later, brings in his son after Sam resigns, so on and so forth. But yeah, it seems like Hinkie was somewhat doomed, because, you know, it's unfortunate. Like, the owners, you know, promised they were on board with this plan. It, you know, I remember there was an article, like, 2013 or 2014, where, like, Dr. J came out and he's like, yeah, I was told this is like a 5 to 7 year plan. And you look right now, this would be year seven of from when Sam got hired to where they are right now. It's like, well, the last 3 years, they've been a 50-win team, and they've made it to the second round of the playoffs every year. I mean, we'll see what happens this year. I should not count my chickens before they hatch in that regard. But
for sure,
you know, they're where he envisioned on the timeline that he envisioned. But, you know, for whatever reason, or a multitude of reasons, it seems, the owners decided to go in a different direction. So I want to talk about the current Sixers a bit as well, but before we do, a couple more questions just about the Hinkie era in general.
Sure.
Did your opinion of the process change as you were writing and reporting this book?
Yeah, I tilted a little bit more toward the criticism of him. Of Hinkie. I should say I tilted. I saw it, right, and I understood a little bit more of it, where it came from, and, like, you know, players aren't assets, right? It's like a weird thing that we've all changed. Like, players are people, and that matters. And, you know, Sam, and, like, it's this, Hinkie knows this, like, he's not a bad guy, and, like, he had, like, you know, his relationship with Embiid, like, they cared, he cared about this stuff, but he was also, I mean, it's a cold business, and he was thinking of it in a cold way. But I think the part, I guess what I should say is, I find myself, the more I report on the NBA, the more I'm around, the more I work on this book, like, it's not that I'm saying all numbers are bad and, like, I'm not Charles Barkley, but I do believe, I do think there is more of a place for old school, I'll call it old school, but just legitimate scouting and intel gathering and, like, culture development, but not in a way that, like, the Nets make up, but, like, in a real way where people feel valued and care. And I think that stuff matters. And I don't think I realized that. I think I was more inclined to say, eh, it doesn't, you win anyway. And maybe the difference is that, like, I think, you know, getting to 50 wins, getting to that step one, almost anyone can do that, right? Like that's the easy part. But to actually get to the championship level, I think that's kind of more where some of the, I'll call it old school stuff, but some of that stuff kind of becomes more valuable and should be valued a little more.
Yeah, for sure. So that leads into my last question about the process area in particular. What misconceptions do you think that either the general public still has about the process or that Sixers fans still have about it?
Oh, that's a good question. Misconceptions. I mean, Sixers fans, it's funny, right? Because there's like different factions, right? Like,
right.
I go back to the other end. So like, yeah, like Hinkie was not like, he dug his own grave a little bit, right? I think that's a misconception. And again, I'm saying that as somebody who's like, what's book isn't a hit job on Hinkie. But no, I think that's a misconception. He contributed to that. Like the Scott O'Neill stuff is, I guess people knew some of that already, the idea that the Sixers front office had a role. I was kind of interested to learn it in my reporting, like how he's pitching StubHub as a sponsorship for the Sixers, to sponsor the Sixers jersey and telling them that like by the time they're on the jerseys, they'll be good, and not mentioning Sam Hinkie at all. But I guess that's not really a misconception. It's a good question. I don't know if I have a good answer to that. That might be the first question I've been asked that I do not have a good answer for.
Nice. I mission accomplished that. Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
Well, I was kind of thinking along two different paths here, because I think a lot of people, you know, from the general public, there's still the perception sometimes of like all Hinkie did was tank for, you know, high draft picks. Like he just wanted to suck for a couple of years, get high draft picks over and over again. And that was definitely a major part of the process. I don't think it was the only part. I mean, you cover in the book, he tried to get bad contracts as long as it came with a pick attached. And sometimes he valued even those minor transactions, like he really valued second round picks at a time where a lot of teams didn't.
Yeah, for sure. Like, not like
too much. Yeah, there was the anecdote about like the Andre Kirilenko trade.
Yeah, that's one where, of my favorites. Yeah.
Yeah, like they trade for him with the understanding, or at least on Kirilenko's side, that okay, we'll trade for you, we're getting a pick, but we're gonna release you because his wife was pregnant at the time. He's living in Brooklyn, he wants to go back up.
And yeah, then she was Sam's on bed rest. Like, he had kids, yeah. She was on bed rest in Brooklyn, yeah.
Yeah. So then Sam's like, well, actually, we're gonna keep you until the trade deadline to see if we can flip you again for a second round pick.
Yeah, that's to me, that's actually one of the best examples, because it's like, it doesn't matter, and like that, just eat it on that one. Just eat it. Like, because you're not going to get more than a second round pick for Andre Kirilenko, who everyone knows you have to trade at the deadline. Right? That's not going to happen. And like, why not just eat it? Even you want to be cold about it. Like, forget even from a, it's the right thing to do. Even from a business standpoint, it makes sense, because I think like if you're weighing a value chart, if you're making a value, like a graph and a value chart, like I think you gain more value from helping your reputation with that than you would from a second round pick that you'll use in 2025. Right? Like, but he just wasn't capable of thinking that way. It just, his brain didn't work. It was just, you know, no, like assets and asset accumulation. And you know, that's a great example, right? Because even if you think you're getting played, and even if you know you swear that no one told me, I didn't trade for him with the assumption I'd release him, like okay, but at some point you learned that that's the case. Why? And they even find him a little bit, because again, and I get it, letter of the law, like he's under contract, he should come, you know, you come to work, but that's just not how it works. And it just, yeah, that's a great example. The other answer I was thinking to, and I'll ask you, well, two things. One, the other answer, but I don't know if Sixers fans feel like this way, is that I've learned that like press conference quotes often don't mean anything. Two is that, and I was going to ask you, so like, what would you say you learned? Like, what would you say? What misconception did this correct for you? Or was there not in one?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I think the Rights Rookie Sanchez guys were probably a little more like Messiah Hinkie than I was. Like I thought I loved what the overall strategy, but like I remember I wrote for a ESPN True Hoop blog at the time of his resignation, and like I said, you know, he played his own role in his demise. Like I don't think a lot of Sixers fans either are aware of the extent of it or didn't realize, like a lot of people just didn't realize the importance of those behind the scenes, like working agents not pissing the community off, even with trades, like you talk about in the book about, you know, like if your sole goal is to win the trade as much as you can and like completely destroy someone, that's great. I mean, it makes total sense. You're trying to get the most value you can, but these guys might not want to trade with you again if they're, you know, like the Kings especially. It's like, well, okay, you bent them over backwards in 2015. That's great. But are they going to want to do business with you again after that? It does seem like the relationship side of things, whether it's with agents, players, or executives of other teams, that's where Hinkie fell the most short, at least based on, you know, the reporting from your book.
Yeah, no, like I would agree. Right, exactly. I don't have, like, I can go. Yeah, yes. Short answer is yes, right? I thought that was important to show, right? And I mean, right, the whole book is just, it's gray area, right? You like, mm-hmm. you can say this, but also this. And like the answer is kind of usually in the middle, which is, I guess, a lot of life. And it's like, you know, I guess everyone contributed to their own whether demise or issues or conflict or whatever, right? Everyone played a role. Nobody was blameless in any of this. I guess that would be how I would summarize it.
For sure. So I want to pivot now to the current Sixers, because while Sam is gone and while a lot of the assets that he got over his 3-year tenure are gone, Brett Brown still remains miraculously. He is still the head coach of the 76ers. And your book does a really good job exposing some of the behind-the-scenes stuff with him that I think hasn't really gone reported as much as it, you know. There was always, like, the why is he always on the hot seat, especially recently? Like, the expectations, sure, but there has to be something else, because, like, it just doesn't make sense that, given all the circumstances he's had to deal with, given – you know, the way he's held this team together through those down years, what's going on behind the scenes? And to highlight some issues, especially as a disciplinarian, like you get the sense that, you know, especially as Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons come in and are starting to gain power in the organization, you know, Brett's voice is becoming less and less respected, perhaps. So do you think, has he lost control of the locker room? Is this, you know, are we looking at like a Kenny Atkinson situation like we just saw in Brooklyn?
I mean, yeah, when the Atkinson thing happens, like I don't, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, but just I have Sixers brain, so I revert everything back to like through a Sixers lens.
It
reminded me a lot of the Brett Brown thing, right? Like, where just the guy goes down. It seems like Kenny kind of removed himself from it, from reports also. Yeah, has he? I mean, I don't know if Brett ever had total control. I don't know if he ever had total control over the locker room, right? And again, the gray area on this is like, yeah, sometimes it's on the players too, right? Or like, you know, they would say, so Nerlens Noel, like they're holding team flights for him, and when he's a rookie and not playing, it's instead of just taking off and he's showing up late, and like they would say, or Brett would say, we fined him a lot. Like, what else? No, when they fined, when they did, but it didn't work. And like, I guess there's like, it's an it factor. I don't even know what you want to describe it. Just either you have it or you don't, right? And he didn't have it. And I think it started with Noel. It's kind of like one of their original sins. Like, he comes in, he's kind of running amok, and Joel comes in, and he's giving them their own problems. And there are good reasons for it. Like, you know, whether it's Noel being a kid and he would spend his whole life with everyone catering to him, or Embiid comes in and his brother is killed, his 10-year-old brother is killed like a month into his NBA career. Like, that's a horrible thing to go through, and like that will affect anyone, right, in a new country. Mm-hmm. So like, there are reasons, and like, it's not, none of this is just, well, Brett Brown's a complete pushover, no one cares. But like, and there are reasons why people would act out, but it happened and nothing was done about it. And at a certain point, it's too far gone, right? Like, you know, you're not gonna, you can't, if you're Brett Brown now, you're not gonna get, like, Joel Embiid's not going to listen to you now. Like, that was 5 years ago. It's not going to change now. And we saw it with, I bring this up example up every time, and it happened after the book, like, was done, and it's almost too bad. But, like, when Brett stands at the Simmons shooting part, right? When he sits at the press conference and says, tell Ben's agent or brother or whatever, I want to see a three from him. It's like, and then we don't see a single three again ever. It's like the most telling thing. And again, Brett's not an idiot. He knows when he says, I mean, I think he knows when he says that, like, there's a chance he's going to make him look stupid, right? Or I shouldn't say stupid. That's too strong. It's going to make him look impotent. Mm-hmm. And he goes for it anyway. It's almost like it feels like a last chance gambit. And that's just, I don't know, if you want to see, like, I like when there are examples when I can give of that. Like, I have all the other reporting and stuff like that, but I like when there are public examples that everyone can see that just like, no, stuff's not made up. Like, this is like, these are real things. And look, you are seeing it yourself too. You on the outside can see it too, if you kind of just pay attention.
Right. And I mean, we've had, you know, you have quotes of the book from Embiid last year when Jimmy comes into the team and he expresses frustration with his role. You know, he's been doing it a lot this year too, where it's like, I'm just standing outside in the perimeter. I don't like taking threes. I like to be in the post, but if this is the role I have to play, and it seems to be shots at both Brett for like the way that he's scheming the offense, but then also Ben Simmons, where it's like, well, if this guy would shoot threes, then I wouldn't have to stand outside the whole time, but he's just being stationed in the dunker spot, so this is what I have to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's funny. I didn't get to listen, like, so we're recording, like, the Jimmy was on JJ's podcast, right?
Yeah.
I saw some of the quotes. I didn't get to fully listen, but no, it seems to back up everything that we knew or kind of I wrote about in the book, not to be that guy, but just, I was happy to hear, like, okay, good, like, I'm not, like, you know, this stuff was right.
Right.
Their relationship there was not great for sure.
Yeah. I want to ask about the Sixers medical staff, because they've kind of become a punchline on Twitter, on like Sixers Twitter. It's just like one thing after another with this team, you know, some of it is fluky, like Nerlens, they drafted with the ACL tear. Of course they knew. Embiid with the foot fractures. I mean, the second one was, as you mentioned in the book, like there's some concern behind the scenes that maybe he's not rehabbing correctly, wearing his walking boot, whatever. You know, Embiid breaks his face on Markelle Fultz's shoulder. That's right. It's you can only do so much about that. But then Markelle's one of the big ones, of course. You know, they draft the kid number. They trade up to draft this kid number one overall. He has a very strange, very short Sixers tenure in which he completely forgets how to shoot. It's mm-hmm. still, you know, he there's still questions, frankly, about whether it was a mental thing, a physical thing. Like, he's eventually diagnosed with thoracic outlet syndrome, and he is traded to Orlando. He gets his fresh start. He is, you know, at least taking threes now, not hitting them at a particularly high clip, but he looks like, I mean, he's playing NBA basketball, which is more than you could say for most of his Sixers tenure. But during your reporting, did you find any behind the scenes concern? Like, you know, at this point, the running joke is like, I don't know if you've seen 30 Rock, but like Dr. Spichemin is the team's doctor, basically. Like, they are completely incompetent. Do you think that's the perception behind the scenes, or is it just like, this is just a weird, weird series of incidents that keep happening to this team?
I mean, I can't say like what the actual I can say what people think, right? Like, I know I put in the book like the story where Brett goes in. They're in Miami last year, right? Like, it's before the Dwayne Wade retirement game, and Embiid's in the middle. I don't know if it was his knee or the flu. I don't know, whatever was going on. I forget which part last year. And he goes in and basically says, we're all going to get fired if Embiid doesn't get healthier in shape or whatever. You know, and has it yells at them. And then I believe, actually, I'm looking this up right now. I believe that I put this in. I want to make sure I put this in before. Yeah, okay, that night. And then later that night, Embiid had a Sixers security guard pick him up for Krispy Kreme donuts for a team flight. So that kind of and I'll be clear, a representative for Embiid denied that was true. So let me put that in there. Okay, fine, done. But to me, that kind of summarizes the whole thing, right? So, yeah, I guess the medical staff there are clearly some weird stuff there. But, like, it's the player. I don't want to say it goes back to a who's in charge thing, but there's just the messaging and the way the organization, the way decisions are made, there are problems and how decisions are made and who gets to have final say on things. And that's, I almost find that more to be more of a problem than the actual medical staff, like Fultz, right? Like, I mean, I think it became pretty clear the Sixers were not of the belief that there was a major shoulder injury, right? I think we could say that. Like, that's not that they got a player who refused to agree with him. That's not on them necessarily. That's different, right? Like, I don't remember what the numbers. Didn't he see like 10 doctors with the Sixers and none found something? Or like then he sees a personal doctor and he finds something? I believe that was the whole order there with the TOS syndrome. And he still can't shoot, I'll say. Like, he's still like, yeah, he takes threes. But if you see a shot, it's not his shot, it's still like the shot's not there.
Yeah.
And even like the numbers, like if you look at his per 36 numbers compared from now compared to what they were when that little stretch in his rookie year when he came back towards the end of the regular season with the Sixers, when he even put up a triple double one of those games, like they're pretty similar. Like he's athletic and can do things on the floor. Like he gets into a game, he can do stuff, but the rest hasn't been there. So you asked about the medical staff. Yeah, even, you know, the Embiid part, like there are people swear it was just a fluke. There are people swear no, Embiid, like, you know, he would walk around without his boot the whole time and mm-hmm. nobody made him, and that affects it. So again, the answer is probably yes to both, right? Like there are reasons these things happen, and you know, it's not, when you have so many repeat instances, they're not coincidences. But I don't put that on the medical staff. They work for people. Maybe that's how I phrase it. I could be wrong, right? But I don't know enough to evaluate what kind of medical evaluations these doctors are doing. I assume they're good at their jobs, right? These people are good at their jobs. Daniel Medina, who was fired by the Sixers, I believe he was officially fired, I'm using the wrong language, whatever, I apologize, last year, gets immediately hired by the Washington Wizards and put a like vice president of whatever the official term is in like this whole new restructuring where on the org chart, he's pretty much in the same level as like the GM, give or take, right? So like other people clearly think these guys are smart. So I don't think that was the issue.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really interesting way to frame it, right? Like, it's not necessarily sure the Sixers doctors, you know, the meniscus, Joel Embiid's meniscus thing, I think 2 years ago at this point was one of the famous examples where, you know, he hurts his knee. They let him play in this nationally televised game against the Rockets. Then he's out with, like, again, another ambiguous, like, they say he's fine, whatever. It's a short-term thing. Then Derek Bodner, I believe he was still independent at the time, now works for the Athletic.
Yep.
He breaks the story that, like, oh, no, it turns out they let him play with a torn meniscus. And then he's shut down for the whole year. We're even seeing it this year to some extent with Ben Simmons and this back injury that he's got recently. Like, he very visibly hurt himself during the All-Star game, was still allowed to play, comes back. They say he hurts his back in practice on Wednesday, misses the Nets game Thursday, comes back to play the Bucks Saturday. You know, plays 4 minutes, very clearly is not able to play, goes back to the locker room. The sideline reporters are saying, like, oh, yeah, this is the plan. Like,
right, exactly.
When he's off the court, he's going to go back to the locker room, get treatment, whatever. We haven't yet to see Ben Simmons since. He's got a nerve impingement in his back. We don't know when he's coming back, if he's coming back at all. So, there's that definitely the perception that, like, we just, for whatever reason, the Sixers are just not as careful with these guys as they used to be when they're like holding Nerlens Noel out the whole year with this ACL tear, even though he probably could have come back, you know, late in the year. But what's the point at that point? You know, now they've moved into this win now window where it's like, okay, these guys can play more hurt than we would have let them play 3 years ago. But it's interesting that you frame it in the perspective of like, yeah, well, these guys also have a say and they also have their role to play in their injury recovery, right? Like the medical staff can't be with them 24/7. So if, you know, with Embiid with the walking boot from back in the early days, like if he's not wearing his walking boot, there's only so much they could do. Like if these guys aren't following the rehab plan they're prescribed, you know, they're not going to get better. That's not the medical staff's fault.
For sure. And I do think also, but I'll say more than the players, like GM/coaching staff/ownership too. I think that they come into it, right? Like just, right. Like I don't believe, maybe I'm wrong. Like, when Joel Embiid hurts his knee and they do an MRI, do they miss a meniscus tear? Maybe. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I can't say anyone's told me otherwise. I find that hard to believe, right? Mm-hmm. I find that hard to believe. So.
Yeah. So a couple questions about the current Sixers, because Josh Harris, the team's managing owner, was recently at Sloan, and he said the following quote, which I found really interesting given the past few years. He said, there's always people that want to have immediate success, and that doesn't really reconcile with what you have to do to win. I always like to think about the day after, the month after, the year after. People have not won in sports that have been volatile in their strategies. And yeah, you know, my gut reaction was like, oh, well, that's not at all in line with how you've been operating this team for the last 4 years. So do you think this current ownership group, front office, whatever, do you think they are operating with a long-term view in mind here, or have they totally shifted into like short-term win now?
They might think they are, but they're not. I don't see how you could argue that. I saw that. Like, I don't see how you could possibly think that. Like, they had that when they came in, right? Like, the Bynum trade. Like, you know, we can rip on or make fun of – I shouldn't say rip, right? You guys can rip. I can point out and critique the ownership in certain decisions. But when they came in, right, they correctly stated – you know, they realized with before the Bynum deal, like, it was worth taking a shot, right? Because mm-hmm. they hit their ceiling. After the Bynum deal, Josh Harris said it's a good process, just bad result. I think he said those exact words, right? Bad results, good process. Mm-hmm. He was right, 100% right. He brings in Sam Hinkie. That's as long term thinking as you can get. But somewhere along the line, they just changed their mind, and it was not just the Colangelos, right? Like, I know, like, the Colangelos coming in, they ran basketball, right? They made basketball. Jerry Colangelo he reports, but, like, he's making basketball decisions, right, if he works for you. But afterwards, like, with the Jimmy Butler and Tobias Harris trade, I don't see how you could possibly argue that, or signing Al Horford. Yeah, there's no way you could argue that. There's no way. They gave up two first-round picks and Landry Shamet for Tobias Harris, right? Like, how is that? How is that long-term thinking? I don't see that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a quote from Hinkie in the book. It appears early on, and it really stood out thinking about this year's Sixers and where they are moving forward. And he said, "The big message was, through a variety of actions and things and circumstances, not any one person's fault, the crops have been eaten, and your future ability to nourish yourself is impaired." Other than Embiid and Simmons, do you think that's where the Sixers are right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. They have nothing to trade, right? Like, I'm fascinated to see what they're going to do this offseason when we assume, and I'm not sourced on this at all, but we assume they're going to trade Al Horford, don't we?
They're going to try, I think. I don't know if they're going to succeed, but they'll probably try.
It's like they have nothing to trade anymore. It's pretty bank people to take Zaire Smith, I guess, right?
Yeah.
It does kind of feel like that. I mean, listen, they have Embiid and Simmons, so you're ahead of the game already, right? No matter what else is going on, like, you will matter, and you have a shot as long as you have those two guys. But otherwise, yeah. The Tobias Harris trade is the one I go back to a lot. It's not his fault. He's a really good player, really good guy, hard worker. But they gave up more than teams usually give up for superstars. You know, right. If you give up two first-round picks and Landry Shamet, you shop that around the league. What are you going to get? There are lots of options. And I always joke, like, the Clippers agreed to that deal, a deal they had to make to trade to clear cap space. They weren't going to re-sign Tobias Harris because they knew they were going to get the other guys. They were hoping to get the other guys, so they wanted to get something for him. And the Clippers agreed to that deal 2 days before the trade deadline. So, right. Like, it wasn't like, oh, we'll take this around, you know, we'll get back to it. It was like, oh, can we sign now?
Right.
And that's usually not a good sign, right?
Yeah. Like, because you noted the agreement happened at, like, 1:30 in the morning on Tuesday before the trade deadline. It's like, the league office isn't open till 9, and I'm sure the Clippers go to bed thinking that. Like, please do not change your mind.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Can we schedule this trade call right now? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I became a pariah on Sixers Twitter for a little bit last year because I was always very skeptical of the Harris trade in general, but also, you know, from a team building perspective, like, the big four model, I don't think it's sustainable for more than a couple of years, as we've seen, you know, time and again this past decade, really. Like, at a certain point, the NBA salary cap works too well. Like, at a certain point, if you have three or four max guys, you're limited in how you could round out the supporting cast. You got to nail your mid-level exception every year. You got to nail your draft picks. Otherwise, your supporting cast leaves, and they're important. Like, having the superstars helps, but how many playoff series are swung, like, by a Fred VanVleet getting super hot and for a couple games? Like, those guys matter too. So that brings us to the big question with the Sixers moving forward is, you know, this has been the hot topic basically since these guys have started playing together, but especially within the last year or two, and being in Simmons. And you touch on this in the book with their relationship that, you know, it hasn't always been great. There was a great anecdote about, like, Brett Brown bringing them into the office one day and being like, look, you guys don't have to be best friends off the court, but what matters is on the court. Do you think their relationship has improved over time?
Okay, so I'll say this. Well, so over a couple of things. One, I have not been around the team as much this year, right? Just I needed a detox a little bit, and I'm sure they were happy not to have me around. So I can't speak. I can only speak to what I hear and seeing things, right? I can't pretend I'm super deep on that one. It does seem like they've improved a little bit, though. Again, it also is like, you know, everything else around them is going bad. They're the only two things that are working, right? It's like easier right. to bond a little bit. And I joke, like, as a basketball fan and somebody who's devoted a lot of time and energy to this story, this team, those two players, thinking about those two, it's kind of frustrating that, like, the roster construction this summer has left us where it's almost like a waste to discuss the fit of Simmons and Embiid because, like, we're not even at that level. Like, that's a yeah. next world that's a next level problem, right? That's like right. a problem you deal with next. Like, we're not even there. Right now, those are the two guys who work. You want those guys on the floor and just hope you can find three people around them that can, you know, get things done. Yeah, I think the relationship did improve over the years. It's just I didn't use this in the book because I came up with it later, but I think the good way to describe it is like the college roommate who you don't like but you kind of gain some sort of respect for and they drive you crazy a little bit. And I think that's what applies here. Like, again, people, like, I see on Twitter sometimes people, like, you know, they'll show a clip of, like, Simmons and Embiid high-fiving and be like, how can you say that these two don't like each other?
Right.
Like, what are you talking? You're not listening to what they're saying. Like, you're not listening. Like, again, there are public quotes out here on this stuff. Whether it's Embiid, Simmons talking about us feeding one guy and Embiid talking about everyone has to stretch themselves a little bit more, right? Like, this stuff happens. Like, this happens and not irregularly, right? Not irregularly. So it's clearly a thing. And their personalities, they're both introverts. I know no one wants to think Embiid's an introvert because he posts on Instagram. But, like, that's not that. That's, like, classic 20 – I guess he's a millennial. But whatever. It's, like, classic modern behavior, right? Like, you can be funny on Instagram but not necessarily know how to – like act with other people, right? Or that's not the right way to phrase it, but just be more comfortable being to yourself. So yeah, but can they work? I mean, yeah, I always found like, I think you can get along, or me phrase, you don't have to be best friends, right? I think Brent was right about that when he brings them in. But it was always the on-court fit that I found more interesting to look at. And like coming into the year, I was of the belief that yeah, I would trade one of them, right? Just from a team building standpoint. But right now, it's like you can't even think about that. But I find the on-court fit fascinating, and I was really interested to see what Simmons would look like this year in the second half. Right? No, sorry, in the second round. You know, if we get to the second round and a healthy team, like he's failed in two straight years in the second round. I was curious, and he's looked really. And this year, he's been his best year, and I think his best season on the court. Like he's looked better, right? He's played well.
For sure.
He's playing well on defense. Even he was starting to take the ball a little bit more strongly to the hoop instead of doing those like dumb like flipsy. Flip shots where it's like he's running off his left leg, right? Okay, like where he's going up strong and squaring up and really driving through. And I'll be curious to see in the second round like what that would look like. And I don't know, I'll say hopefully we get there. I don't have a rooting interest just from somebody who's devoted so much time to thinking about this stuff. I would love to see it.
Right. Yeah. I think that's like, at this point, it feels like the best case scenario is they get to the second round.
Yeah, right. I know.
I mean, they've been horrible on the road. They're staring at either Miami or Boston in the first round. Both of those teams are going to have boogeymen for them, whether it's Jimmy Butler in Miami or, you know, Boston from 2 years ago and Jason Tatum. It's going to be a narrative mess. But it's interesting to hear that you've like come around at least to, you know, oh, well, you know, do they need to trade one of these two guys? Well, it's not even like there are so many other problems to address. Do you think, you know, barring a shocking run to the NBA Finals, is Brett Brown a dead man walking at this point?
So I'll be careful. Like, so again, this is completely not sourced and all guessing and just hearing from people around the league who are also guessing, right? Like nobody and like not people who know, like who are talking to Judge Harris. It does seem like he's in trouble, right? It does seem like that. And I mean, also just basic how NBA works, right? Like if they lose in the first round, they're going to make a change and it's not going to be trading Simmons or Embiid.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would say a betting man would be that things aren't looking great for him. That's for sure.
Great. What on that uplifting note, the last question I have for you is, you know, if they were to trade one of Simmons or Embiid, did you get any sense from your time around the team which one they would prefer to flip?
Oh, that's a good question. The answer is none, right? I don't know. Like they like having the stars, right? I know it's been like I've had a few people ask me recently like about Embiid's relationship with ownership and whatever, like is he not happy with them? And I always thought it was the other way, that like he got the run of the place, and like he's really, or he was at least to a certain point, I don't know, close as far as throughout my reporting, he was close with Michael Rubin, the minority owner, really close, right? Closer than most players are with owners. So I guess if I had to default, I would go with that. Like he seems to have a little more protection from above or Ben Simmons. And it makes sense, right? He's more of the star, isn't he? Like, it's almost two separate questions, right? I guess if you're going... So the answer is, I don't know. I have no idea. If you're going, like, the answer, I guess, is there's so many ways. Like, Simmons is probably a better long-term bet just because of health, right?
Sure.
Embiid's a bigger star and more, and you know, you in terms of marketing and things like that, like he fits that role more, and he's more of the larger than life guy who, you know, is sort of in with ownership. But yeah, that's a good question. Honestly, I don't know, and I don't say that as a cop. I know it sounds like a cop out. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I don't think there's an easy answer here necessarily, because as you said, there's competing interests in mind here. Like, I'm sure Scott O'Neill would have one guy he'd prefer to flip more than the other, but then Josh Harris weighs in, and you know, Elton Brand and the rest of the front office weighs in. Like, and it was really interesting in your book to kind of see how many different competing voices are weighing in on these basketball decisions and how that all factors in.
Oh yeah, for sure, right? It's like, yeah, it's not. And again, I'm sure it happens in a lot of places, but I don't know if there's like the guy who just gets to put it, like they don't have the guy, and it was Hinkie and then Colangelo's or whatever, but like they don't have, I'd use this as it's a silly example, but it's telling, right? They have GM, they don't have a president of basketball operations, and they care about titles, right? Hinkie and Colangelo were presidents of basketball operations, Elton Brand is a GM, and I don't think that's an accident. Like the Sixers care about their org chart. Some places do, they don't. Some places don't, they do. Yeah. And I think that's kind of telling, right? There's no hammer, right? Who's the hammer in this stuff? There's nobody who is that except ownership, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Yaron, thank you for taking the time again for speaking with us today. One more time, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can get the book?
Sure. Thank you for having me. Yaron Weitzman, YaronWeitzman on Twitter. You can get the book where all books are sold, Amazon, the rest. If you want to see other places to purchase the book, you can check out my Twitter feed. I have a link to the publisher page, which has all sorts of links to indie bookstores, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you would like.
Good stuff. And check out Yaron on Bleacher Report as well.
Yes.
I say this to keep both of our bosses happy.
There you go.
No, you've been a great writer for years. Honestly, like Sixers fans, you should already have this book pre-ordered, but really anyone who's interested about the behind-the-scenes team-building aspect of the NBA, really check out this book. It's a riveting read. There's one anecdote in particular that I don't want to spoil about Jimmy Butler and Karl Anthony Towns that I feel like it's going to be every single aggregator is going to have that up next week.
Yeah, Jimmy, that was certainly it. Jimmy's Butler, yeah, right. The reputation is there for a reason, right?
Yes, yeah. We'll leave it at that. But thanks again, Yaron. Best of luck with the book, and let's chat soon.
Sounds good. I appreciate it. Thank you.